Okay, so who can remember the verse for the year? You all went silent on Jay when he asked last week, so surely someone's remembered by now. The verse for the year is... Someone's muttering it, sorry. Come on, Karen, help them all out. Go on then. You got the right sort of, yeah. In your hearts, revere Christ as Lord, and always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And so we've split our teaching for the year into three strands. And one is, what does it mean to revere Christ as Lord? And the other is, let's try and equip ourselves to answer some of the questions that we might get asked. And the third strand is, what kind of person gets asked a question? You know, why have you got a hope, right? So what makes us different as Christians that might make people want to ask us about our faith? So this morning's subject is from that last strand, you know, what makes Christians different? And the subject is integrity. And we're going to get there by a bit of a circuitous route. We're going to start by reading from Isaiah chapter 6. This was brought to us twice last week, and it's a passage that's been on my heart all week, and there's some great things for us to, which will take us on the journey that will get us to the subject of integrity. So Isaiah chapter 6, I think it'll be coming up behind in a moment, goes like this. And Isaiah, he was just an ordinary prophet. I mean, you know, I suppose prophets aren't really ordinary, but as prophets go, he was an ordinary prophet. And then this happened, right? And this seems to have been like the transformational moment in Isaiah's life, where he went on to be one of the great prophets who really had a powerful message to take to the people of Israel. And it goes like this: in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And above him were seraphs, each with six wings. And with two wings they covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." And at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "And woe to me," I cried, "I'm ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." And one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he'd taken with tongs from the altar. And with it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am. Send me." So Isaiah, an ordinary prophet, turns up in Jerusalem to visit the temple. And something strange happens when he's there. Normally he's kind of used to being in the temple and listening to the music and bringing his sacrifices and so on. And suddenly, it's as if the roof of the temple isn't there anymore, and he looks up and he sees what was always there, but which had just never been visible to him. And he sees an elevated throne, a throne high up, because God is exalted, right? God is above, God doesn't sit on a throne down here. God sits on a throne that's high up. Symbolically, he's saying he's over. This is a super king, a king above all kings. He sees God on an exalted throne, and there's majesty everywhere. The train of the robe, you know, just the end bit of God's glory, just the end of his clothing, is so big that it fills the entire temple. As he's on the throne up above the temple, you can just see this robe flowing down and coming down into the temple, and that completely fills the temple. Just the corner of the robe that he's wearing. And that's not all that Isaiah sees. He sees this majesty. And then he sees the seraphs, or seraphim, according to how you want to put your plural. And the word means burning ones. That's how it translates literally. They're some kind of angelic being. We don't know a great deal about them. And these burning ones, they're powerful attendants surrounding the throne. And there's flashes of light and power, which just remind us just how great this God is that he's got a vision of. And it's interesting because in Egyptian mythology, then the kings and the gods, sorry, are supposed to be surrounded by flying beings. But those beings were there to defend the king in case, or to defend the god in case any harm should come to them. But these seraphs, it's the other way around. They need to be defended from the king because they're having to cover their eyes with two of their wings because they can't stand the brightness of the glory that they see before them. So they're covering their eyes with two of their wings, and they're covering their feet with two of their wings. And that's kind of symbolically saying, I'm not going to the place where I want to go. I'm going to go to the place where you want me to go, God. And they're using the other two wings in God's service, flying around the throne. But he doesn't just see stuff. He hears stuff as well when he's in God's presence. And you might have expected these seraphim, as they're flying around the throne, to be talking about God's legitimacy and his power and his authority. But they don't mention those things. Instead, they say the same thing over and over again. Normally in Hebrew, if you want to really emphasize something, if you want to use a superlative, you say it twice. This is a super superlative, because they say it three times, not just once. Holy. Holy. No, I really, really mean this. Holy is the Lord Almighty. And so they tell each other, and they tell Isaiah, and they tell the world and anyone who listen that God is holy. And they say that his holiness and his glory fills the whole world. It's not just Isaiah who's seeing the glory, but his glory is actually there in the temple. For anyone who's in the temple, but it's there for anyone who's in Jerusalem, anyone who's in the land of Israel or Judah, anyone who actually is in the whole world, anyone in from China and Australia through to the Incas or whoever was sort of the current races in Latin America, then the whole world full of God's glory, not restricted by geography or history. But he doesn't just see stuff and hear stuff; he also senses it. In the presence of God, those huge, solid stones of the temple are shaking before the power of God. And he sees and he smells the smoke, the burning holiness, destroying impurity. And in the face of that vision, how does Isaiah feel? He says, I'm ruined. Another way of translating that would be to say, I've unraveled. I've come apart. He starts to realize that he hasn't got that holy, holy, holiness that God has. And he can start to see these inconsistencies in himself. He's unraveling. He's worried about his lips. Why his lips? Well, he's a prophet. Right? You know, if you're a prophet, then, you know, if you're a potter, you use your hands. If you're a runner, you use your legs. If you're a prophet, you use your lips. And Isaiah's concerned about his lips. Perhaps, before he saw this vision, he was in the temple, singing along to the music, and actually wondering what he was going to have for his dinner. Maybe he's been using his lips not really the way that he should have been using them. Perhaps he's thinking about some prophecies he might have done for money rather than because God had asked him to do it. I don't know. But he's worried about his lips. Maybe he's worshipped lightly or trivially. Maybe his lips have given expression to his heart in a way that he's ashamed of. And Isaiah is self-deprecating. He says, woe to me, I'm ruined. But God wants healing. And so one of the seraphs comes along and picks up a coal from the altar. I don't know which altar, altar of incense, the altar of burnt offerings. I don't know which one. There were two altars in the temple. But he brings a coal from the altar and he puts it on his lips. And you might have expected that to lead to disfigurement and, you know, kind of like some burns all over his lips. But the burning coal doesn't hurt his lips at all. It brings healing, purification. His lips are now ready as a prophet. And so when God gives them the commission and says, who's going to go for me? Then he's ready to say, I'll go. My lips have been sorted. I'll go. And Isaiah is totally and utterly changed from that point forward. He becomes the fearless prophet who preaches with integrity despite an incredible amount of political opposition. So, is Isaiah alone in his experience? Is this a once in history encounter with God that no one else can hope to know about? It's not. I could give you the passages, but you'll have burnt Sunday lunches if you've got the oven on. That is, but you'll be late for dinner if I went through them all. But let's give you some other ideas, right? So Jesus, he went for a long walk up to the top of a high mountain with his disciples. You had to be fit if you wanted to be a follower of Jesus. It was no good being unable to climb mountains because he seemed to regularly go to the top of high mountains. But Jesus went to the top of a high mountain, and when he was up there with a few of his disciples, then he changed. And suddenly his face started shining and his clothes just turned white. Which kind of brings Isaiah's burning ones, the seraphs, to mind. And God symbolized by fire in the Old Testament. So Jesus' deity and divine calling are emphasized. And the disciples look at him. And some long dead prophets sort of turn up and they start talking to him, which show that he has power over death. And the disciples fall down. They're terrified, absolutely terrified, just like Isaiah was. And like Isaiah, they're told, it's okay, get up, I'll look after you. But now, after that encounter, they were ready to face Jesus' death and resurrection and the coming of the Holy Spirit. But it wasn't just the disciples. Paul the Apostle, on the road to Damascus, on his way, intending to go and murder some Christians. And a light comes from heaven and God speaks to him. And the same thing happens. He falls to the floor, but he's restored. He's blinded. And a few days later, his sight is given back to him. And he turns around, and he's no longer the persecutor of Christians, but he becomes one of the greatest Christians. A bit like Donald Trump. I'm going to mention him later, that's why. But a bit like Donald Trump going to Syria to join ISIS. It's that kind of remarkable. And others, Moses saw the burning bush. And he saw this encounter with God and it changed a meek man into a great leader. John on Patmos in the book of Revelation, he sees a vision of Jesus and he falls at his feet as though dead and then writes the great prophecy of Revelation. Joshua sees the commander of the army of the Lord, the soldiers in Gethsemane, they fall before Jesus when they get a glimpse of his glory. Gideon again meets the angel of the Lord. And we've got this pattern, right? We've got this pattern. The pattern is this. Someone encounters God. And they're absolutely terrified. They recognize how holy he is and how unholy they are. And God restores them and they're changed forever. So what we can learn from all of these encounters is this. If we want God to change us, it starts with an encounter with him. So when I talk about integrity, as I'm going to in a moment, we don't have integrity as Christians because we've gritted our teeth and got up in the morning and said, I'm going to have more integrity in my life. Because although that might be a good thing to do, we'd end up failing horribly. But if it starts with an encounter with God, then we've got a chance of it finishing. So bear that in mind. We'll come back to some of these thoughts. And let's read from Matthew chapter 5 and find out what Jesus has to say about one aspect of integrity, which is honesty. And Matthew chapter 5, verse 33, if you're reading it yourself, says this. Again, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, don't break your oath, but keep the oaths you've made to the Lord. But I tell you, don't swear at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by the earth, for it's his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And don't swear by your head, for you can't make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no be no, and anything beyond this comes from the evil one. So, Jesus is saying this. there's no hierarchy of truth in your life, right? You don't kind of like say one thing when you've got your fingers crossed, another thing when you haven't got your fingers crossed but you're in casual conversation, another thing when you say, I'm telling you the truth now, really, this is it, and another thing when you're in court, and another thing when you're talking to your lawyer. Yet you don't have different standards of truth. He says, no, if you're people of integrity, then when you say yes, you mean yes. You don't try and mislead people. You don't, you don't kind of construe your sentences in such a way that people think that you mean this when it could be grammatically constructed in that way so that you've carefully deceived them without breaking your word, right? You don't do that kind of stuff. You should have a reputation for honesty, and you should have a reputation for integrity. Your yes should be yes, and your no should be no. And integrity is an important part of the holiness that Isaiah encountered when he saw God enthroned above the temple. It happens when your life matches what you say. And perhaps the best example that I can think of in the Bible of someone's life matching what they say, apart from Jesus, of course, is Samuel. So Samuel was the last of the judges. At the time when Samuel was living, the nation of Israel didn't have kings. They were ruled by religious leaders, by judges. And at some point then they said, we've had enough of this judges nonsense. We won't have a king. So Samuel went out and found them a king. And Saul was their first king, and he wasn't terribly good, but that's another story altogether. And just as Samuel has appointed Saul as king, he gives a farewell speech and says, look, you know, I've led you for years. It's been great, guys, but I'm moving on. Because that's what you want. And it's a kind of like tearful occasion, the great farewell to the great judge. And hundreds have gathered. And Samuel says this. Samuel said to all Israel, I've listened to everything you've said to me, and I've set a king over you. There you go, they've got their king now. And now you have a king as a leader. But as for me, I'm old and I'm grey, and my sons are here with you. I've been your leader from my youth until this day, and here I stand. Okay. So he's led the nation for a long time. Here I stand, right? Now this is important, listen to this. Here I stand. Testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I've done any of these things, I will make it right. And so Samuel invites, in the presence of as many people as he can find, he invites the nation to assess his career as a leader. And he says, have I abused my power? Right? Have I taken a bribe? Have I done anything unjust in any way at all? Now, we kind of like to sort of pride ourselves on, relatively speaking, good government in the Western world, don't we? You know, we like to think that we've got checks and balances on power and that our leaders don't take bribes, and we have all these democratic accountabilities going on, media scrutiny of people's actions and so on. But I ask you, right, how would Twitter react if David Cameron, shortly before resigning as Prime Minister, had asked the same questions that Samuel had asked and said, when have I ever done anything unfair? When have I ever cheated anyone? When have I ever not done what I'd said that I would do? And you can just imagine the Twitter sphere going into meltdown as people remind all the times when, you know, he's kind of like ducked and dived and weaved and all that kind of thing. And I've not got anything against David Cameron. I'm not trying to make any political point. I could have chosen the name of any leader, of any politician, of any nation. You know, What if the question had been asked of Robert Mugabe or Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian former president who was voted out or impeached earlier this week? Or even the next president? Did you know that The latest opinion poll I could find, that 58% of the American population think that one of their presidential candidates is untrustworthy. Donald Trump. Right? So less than a third of the American population think that their possible next president is trustworthy. But that's not all. Because 58% think that Donald Trump's untrustworthy, but 57% think that Hillary Clinton's untrustworthy. So they're both the same. Right? So we don't trust our leaders. We don't believe that they tell the truth. And that's politicians. But figures from my own profession, finance, would be just as bad. How many people here want to put their hands up and say they trust bankers? There's no hands gone up. Right? What about others? What about plumbers? What about estate agents? What about politicians, lawyers, tax advisors? We don't trust any of them, do we? Right? We don't trust any of those people. But Samuel, as a political leader, is standing in front of the nation and saying, "Do you trust me? Have I done what's right all my life? And if it's not, I'll put it right." And what happens? Do you get a run of people coming saying, "You put taxes up too high and I want to have my donkey back that you taxed me for"? You don't get any of that. Instead, the people reply by saying this: "You have not cheated or oppressed us," they replied. "You have not taken anything from anyone's hand." And Samuel said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and also his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand." "And he is witness," they said. A life full of integrity. And as Christians, if we've had an Isaiah-style encounter with God, then we should be able to ask the same question of anyone that we know and have them give the same answer that was given to Samuel, that we are trustworthy. And that's integrity. So let's pick the scab a little. Have you got authority in any way? Perhaps you're a manager at work. Maybe you're a teacher. That gives you authority. Maybe you're a parent. That does. Perhaps you provide services to people. You know, maybe you're I mentioned plumbers before. Maybe you're a plumber or something like that. A tradesman, perhaps. You've got customers, maybe. What if questions like this were asked of your staff or your customers or your children? Have you ever cheated anyone? Have you ever been unfair? Have you ever hidden the price of something? Have you ever allowed your decisions to be influenced inappropriately? Have you ever failed to deliver on the things that you promised that you'd deliver? Because as Christians, we should always get a Samuel-style answer to those questions. Because God, our God, is a God who can be trusted. And he's the same yesterday, today, forever. And he keeps his promises, and his covenants are inviolable. And we can rely on him. And the Bible doesn't change mysteriously across the centuries. And God doesn't vacillate as culture changes. He expects his people, that's you and me, to be like him. And ordinarily, that would be impossible. Which is why we need an encounter with God like Isaiah had. And God to be living in us. Because the opposite of integrity is hypocrisy. Jesus singled out the Pharisees as being particular hypocrites. And Jesus gave a big sermon on hypocrisy in the Pharisees. You can read it all in Matthew chapter 23. But it's quite a long chapter. But Matthew chapter 23 reminds us that Jesus was not always the nice guy that you might remember from your Sunday school lessons. And sometimes he said harsh and difficult things. And the Pharisees failed the integrity test. And he made it very clear. The Pharisees worried about small visible things and ignored big complex and hard to measure things. So Jesus said things like this to them: "Woe to you, you teachers of the law and the Pharisee, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint and dill and cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain at a gnat, but swallow a camel. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness. For the Pharisees, the religious teachers in Jesus' day, then they spend ages arguing about whether or not when you planted a pot on your kitchen windowsill and grew some chives in it, whether when you cut the chives down, you should cut off a tenth of them and take those chives into the temple and offer them as a sacrifice to God. Well, you know, if you're going to tithe literally, then yes, you should. But how much more important to care about love and mercy and justice? And sometimes it's easy to have a tick box mentality to Christianity. You know, you create your own little litmus tests for spirituality. And ignore the big matters of integrity. And so decades ago, then it might have been the litmus test in this country would have been, are you teetotal? Do you ever touch tobacco? Do you gamble? Right? And if you didn't do those things, then that was okay. You were a good evangelical Christian. And if you did any of them, then you were on your way to outer darkness. And today the litmus test might be different. It might be people arguing about women's ministry or gay marriage. But Jesus says that a holy life of integrity won't worry about the minutiae. It'll focus on justice and mercy and faithfulness. And those things are harder to measure and they're much harder to put into place. But don't ever think that you can make your Christian life a tick box exercise on a couple of key teachings, because you can't. Which brings us into understanding integrity. The difference, and I'm sorry for playing with words here, and I hope you'll get what I'm saying, the difference between ethics and morality. So ethics is this. Ethics is what you think, what you teach, what you say is right and wrong. So if I say that it's wrong to steal, then that's my ethics, right? So ethics is what you teach and what you say. And your morality is what you actually do. So I might say that it's wrong to steal, but I might be quite happy to steal from my employer and submit a fraudulent or exaggerated expense claim, say, right? Now, those two things can be out of sync or they can be in sync. And you can have a high standard of ethics where you say, oh, this is the standard that we should live by, but you can actually end up living down here. On the other hand, you could have a very low standard of ethics, but actually have a very high standard of morality, so you actually live up here. And it's important for us to understand the difference between what we say and what we do. And hypocrisy is when there's a disconnect between the two, one's high and the other's low, right? And integrity is when they're the same. So in principle, you can have integrity by saying, it doesn't matter what you do in life, and then you go out and you do whatever you want. At least, you know, you're consistent, aren't you? You're not a hypocrite. But the Bible doesn't give us that kind of ethic. The Bible gives us an ethic, a standard of behaviour that's right, that's up here. And with lives of integrity, we're expecting our behaviour to match what we say. And we should be living in this plane. So, just to put this into a bit more practice. So if I, you know, like part of my job is to design financial products, right? So if I, as a designer of financial products, say that I've got no reason to care about potentially vulnerable customers, then I've got pretty low ethics. If I actually take advantage, when I design my products, of vulnerable borrowers, then I've got low morality. So the reason that I gave an example like that for me from work is this. It's really easy for us to think that ethics and morality relate to what we do in church. But really they relate to what we do all day, every day. And that's why I was so interested in what Izzy was telling us earlier. You know, being a Christian is much more than about being in church on a Sunday morning. It's about sitting down with your friends and cooking a meal for them because you care about them. And praying for them because you care about them, even though they might not have any time for the God that you're praying to. Because you care about them. Because that's what Christians do. And integrity goes far beyond a Sunday morning. It reaches into every part of our lives. And so I should have as much integrity when I'm in work as I do when I'm talking to you on a Sunday morning. And if I don't, I'm a crass failure as a Christian. So not many of us have encountered God quite as dramatically as Isaiah did. But most, maybe all of us, have encountered him. I still remember my first encounter with God. I was in a camp, Christian camp, down in Boverton. And I realised that the God of my parents needed to become my God as well. And that changed my life. But it wasn't the first encounter. There are plenty more encounters with God since then. And think back to some of your encounters with God. And how perhaps you intended to serve and to follow him and to fill your life with integrity as a result of seeing that holiness. And I hope that you've lived up to the calling that you received. But maybe you haven't. Maybe that kite has got stuck in the tree. But God wants to take it out. God wants to give you the chance to live a life of integrity, even though you might not have done so in the past. And so, for those of you who are in business or in work, he wants you to be able to go forward and give the right answer to questions like these. Am I honest? Do I gouge my customers with hidden terms and unexpected costs? And do I pay my taxes on time? And do I pay my suppliers on time? And do I pay a fair price for my goods and my services? And do I deliver on my promises that I make to my customers? Do I honour my staff? Am I fair when employees fall short of my expectations of them? Do I place unfair burdens on the people who work for me? These are things that as a Christian I should be demonstrating Christ-like behaviour in. I can't leave my faith at the door of my office. In our social relationships, I can't be the kind of person who praises people to their friends and criticizes them behind their backs. I can't be the kind of person who manipulates and takes advantage of others. I must be the kind of person who always wants the best for others, to not be jealous of friends who succeed or fail, to be dependable, to value people according to their character rather than according to their status. I need to have friends, not spiritual projects. What is the point in having high standards of ethics, of teaching, if my morality doesn't live up to it? If I fail in that way, I have no integrity. And one more thought. Some of you have met my favourite son. I'm allowed to have a favourite son. He's adopted, my favourite son. He's a dog, actually. He's Jackson. He's nicer than any of my actual sort of my proper children, because he doesn't answer me back as much, and he's always there for me. He's lovely, Jackson. But I have to say that Jackson has got a fault. He's a terrible cheat. Right, so you know, if you play fetch with Jackson, then if he knows that you're watching him, he doesn't start running until you throw the ball. But as soon as he thinks you can't see him, then he's sprinting long before the ball's thrown. He knows that he's not allowed to put his paws on the kitchen work surface, and he's definitely not allowed to nick food off it. But if you kind of go out of the room and he thinks that you can't see, then he has been known to cheat. And it has just occasionally, you've kind of heard this like slobbering sound, and you look around the corner and there's Jackson licking up some gravy that's been spilled on the work surface. He's an awful cheat. He knows how to behave when I'm there, but he doesn't always behave right when I'm not there. And Jesus said that we've got to uphold our morality even when no one's looking. We're not to be like Jackson. I can't blame him. He's only a dog. But we ought to know better. And so I ask you, you know, what about integrity? Do your internet, your TV habits, do they change horribly when no one's looking? You know, when you're kind of like posting comments online, are they rather different when you're posting as anonymous coward rather than posting under your name? I don't know. Do we change when no one's looking? Do we only pray or read the Bible when people know what we're doing? If so, we're lacking integrity. So let's recap. Isaiah saw an extraordinary vision. God is, above all else, totally and consistently holy. And an encounter with that holy God always changes people. Everyone we read about in the Bible who encountered God gets changed. And if we've encountered God, we will change. And if we haven't changed, we probably actually haven't really encountered him. And truly great spiritual giants like Samuel had strong integrity drawn from God's holiness. And that comes when your behavior matches your ethical teaching. And the Pharisees thought they could gain integrity from trivial tick box visible virtue signals, as they're sometimes called. And they were wrong. It comes from the weighty matters. Some people keep their integrity for church. But Izzy has told us that that's wrong. Our entire life must be lived out for the glory of God. Because integrity permeates every part of our life. Church, family, social, professional, and it must change us.